From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. He was born Shmuel Gelbfish, a poor Polish Jew, but he changed his name, rewrote his past, and transformed himself into movie mogul Samuel Goldwyn. Biographer A. Scott Berg has spent a decade chronicling that transformation, and on today's Fresh Air, he talks with us about Goldwyn and his movies. Also today, Sally Field reflects on going from Gidget and the Flying Nun to Academy Award-winning performances. Critic Ken Tucker takes a fresh look at The Great Ziegfeld, the 1936 classic is now available on home video. And pianist Dave McKenna is back on our weekly performance spot with a medley of songs for April. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Samuel Goldwyn was one of the moguls that made Hollywood the movie capital of the world. The movies he produced include Wuthering Heights, Stella Dallas, The Best Years of Our Lives, The Little Foxes, The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, and Guys and Dolls. Goldwyn died in his mid-90s in 1974. A. Scott Berg has written a new biography of Goldwyn. Berg is also the author of a biography of Maxwell Perkins, the celebrated literary editor who worked with F. Scott Fitzgerald, Ernest Hemingway, and Thomas Wolfe. I asked Berg to give us a sense of Goldwyn's place in the movie world.
I think Samuel Goldwyn was the most important independent producer in the history of Hollywood, and it was he who helped start MGM, United Artists, Paramount Studios, and most important, created the whole mold of the creative independent producer that's really running Hollywood today.
When Samuel Goldwyn Jr. Asked you to write the biography of his father, you were, I think, a 30-year-old writer who had already written an acclaimed biography of a great literary editor. Now, that doesn't seem like the first credit that someone would look for a person to write the biography of a film mogul. Why did Goldwyn Jr. choose you? Do you know?
Well, I think I have some ideas, and I think it was to his credit in a way. I mean, not to have picked me specifically, but generically, which is to say, I think he knew his father was a man of great importance culturally, amusingly enough, to the United States and the world because of his place in film. But beyond that, he also knew that he had 60 years of archives, which he locked up the day his father died. And I think he knew that those papers should only be turned over to a respectable biographer, someone who would appreciate Samuel Goldwyn as an important cultural figure. So I think that's what drove him to me. Beyond that, he also knew I grew up in Los Angeles with a family in show business, so he knew I wasn't in awe of show business, but that I loved it. And I think those were the reasons.
Your father's a TV producer.
He is a producer, and then I have an older brother who is an agent as well.
So what was in the archives? I know millions and millions of things, but can you give us an overall sense of what you found in there?
Yeah, overall, these archives included every letter Samuel Goldwyn received, a carbon copy of every letter, memo, whatever he ever sent out, contracts, gin rummy IOUs. There were the menu books that Mrs. Goldwyn kept after each party of which guests were there. There were photographs by the tens of thousands. Literally every bit of minutia that ever crossed Sam Goldwyn's desk were contained in these two huge vaults.
So that gave you a lot to go through. Now, this is an authorized biography. What exactly does that mean?
Well, actually, yes, it's, quote, an authorized biography. It's an unusual situation in that it's authorized in that the family said, that is, Sam Goldwyn said, I would be the only person allowed to go through those papers, which really do give you 60 years of Hollywood history as well as Goldwyn's personal history. But it's not authorized in that he had no control over what went into the book. And in fact, before I started to write the book, I wanted him to sign a piece of paper, which he ultimately did, which said anything I found in those papers could be written in the book and that he would have no final cut over what I wrote.
Were there any arguments between you about how the book should be handled?
Well, ultimately, there were not. I mean, to be honest with you, it took a year from the time he first called me to ask if I was interested in writing the book and his signing of that document I just told you about.
Right.
He really did balk, but he finally realized that the only way he was going to get me or a serious biographer to take on his father was in signing such an agreement. And he did. And once he did, he was a most candid interviewee. I did 60 hours of interviews with him alone. And I always found him very, very honest and forthcoming.
Scott Berg is my guest when we're discussing his new biography of Samuel Goldwyn. Early in your book, you say that Goldwyn, at an early age, invented himself. Can you compare who he was with who he turned himself into?
Oh, absolutely. You know, we're all dealt a hand at birth, and I think Samuel Goldwyn was dealt as low a hand as you could get. He was born in Warsaw, named Shmuel Gelbfish. His father ran a junk store and died very young, leaving Shmuel with his five siblings and a mother whom he really didn't care for that much. The pogroms were at their height in Poland, and I think he realized the only way to survive was to get out of Warsaw. And so at 15, he decided to leave, and he walked across Europe. And I mean that literally. He went to Hamburg, where he got on a boat, went to England, where he had some relatives, and he walked across England to Birmingham to be with them. And then after a few years there, he got on a boat, traveled steerage class, was an illegal alien, sneaked across the Canadian border into America, went to New York, and almost immediately upon arrival, heard about a little town upstate called Gloversville, where indeed they needed people to make gloves. And that's what Samuel Goldwyn did in the beginning, and really stayed in Gloversville for many years, first as a glove maker, and then he became a glove salesman. Now that's who he started out as. All his life he began this process of invention, and he kept inventing his way up. And ultimately he changed his name to Samuel Goldwyn, not just because it was a more euphonious name, as indeed it was, but he went into business, this is when he was named Samuel Goldfish, with the Selwyn brothers. So they took the most lucrative sounding syllables of each name, Gold and Wynn, put it together, leaving Selfish Productions behind, and then really began the serious process of invention, which really had to do with turning himself into a gentleman. He was never educated. He was really semi-literate at best, but he always had artistic aspirations, and I think that's what pulled him through in many ways and really contributed to this invention.
And you think it's appropriate, I'm sure, that someone who invented himself should also be funding the invention of American fantasies in film.
No doubt about it. And frankly, Terry, that was one of the things that drew me to the book, because I saw that he was such a perfect metaphor for the American dream, if you will. Not only did he believe in it, he grew up hearing about it, but then he came to America and lived it, and he made his living by manufacturing it.
I think most everyone thinks of Samuel Goldwyn as the G in MGM, and indeed he briefly was, but only briefly.
Yes, that's true. I mean, MGM is in fact the great misnomer in Hollywood history. Goldwyn did start the Goldwyn Company with the Selwyn brothers, but he was, after a few years, kicked out of the company, as he was kicked out of most companies he was involved in, simply because he couldn't have partners. People couldn't stand being around him, basically. And then the Goldwyn Company merged with Metro and Louis B. Mayer and became MGM. So, indeed, he was not part of the company when the merger took place. It's interesting because he's really one of the few men ever named after a company. After the Goldwyn Company got off the ground, he legally petitioned to change his name to Goldwyn. But MGM, in fact, bought the Goldwyn Company name, not the man.
Well, so MGM, however, kept the logo that he had created, the lion.
Absolutely.
What's the story behind how the lion was created for the logo of the movies?
Well, actually, he hired a PR man named Howard Dietz, who later went on to become an amazing phenomenon in show business history, running the press office for MGM in its heyday, and also being a Broadway composer by night, writing some very important tunes.
With Arthur Schwartz.
Yes, exactly right. And Howard Dietz, while working for Goldwyn, was a Columbia University graduate, and was asked to come up with a logo. So he really borrowed the Columbia Lion. Now, at the same time, the Goldwyn offices were literally across the street from the New York Public Library, which had these gleaming pink lions out in front, chiseled in marble. And the positioning of the lion was actually borrowed from the library. And so it remained. And it was Arthur Dietz again who threw in the ars gratia artis. He thought, gee, movies... Goldwyn wanted everything to be classy. He wanted his pictures to be elegant. So Dietz thought, I better throw in a little Latin to make it sound fancy.
So Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer bared Samuel Goldwyn's name, although he wasn't part of the company. How did he tag his own movies?
It said Samuel Goldwyn Presents, and then it said a Samuel Goldwyn production. And everyone thought this was sheer egotism on his part, getting his name up there twice. But in fact, when he started to make his own movies, MGM sued him, saying, you cannot use the Goldwyn name. We bought that. And he went to court over it. And finally, Judge Learned Hand said, a self-made man is entitled to a self-made name. Mr. Goldwyn may use his name, so long as he makes it clear he is not part of MGM. And then after a few years, the courts and MGM said he could simply say Samuel Goldwyn Presents, whatever the movie was.
So you've explained his role in MGM, or lack of it.
Yes.
What about with United Artists, with whom he was affiliated?
Well, now, you see, Sam Goldwyn was an independent producer. And as a producer of films, he then needed somebody to distribute them. And beginning in 1919, this new idea hit motion pictures, which was the artists themselves actually distributing their own movies. And it began when Charlie Chaplin, Mary Pickford, Douglas Fairbanks, and D.W. Griffith formed their own distribution company. And they realized they were the biggest money makers in movies. Why should they not produce their pictures and then distribute them themselves? Now, when talkies came in, their careers were all on the way out. And they needed somebody else to keep the company going. So they were constantly looking for new independent producers who might keep them supplied with product. And that's where Sam Goldwyn came in. They brought him in ultimately as a partner to distribute his films. And really, throughout the late 20s and early 30s, it was the Samuel Goldwyn films that kept that company alive. And then, as invariably happened with every company that Samuel Goldwyn belonged to, he wanted to take it over, and the partners wanted to get rid of him, which they ultimately did.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about his very first movie, and this is back in 1913 that it was made. It was called Squaw Man. It was directed by Jesse Lasky, who was Goldwyn's brother-in-law at the time.
It was really produced by Lasky with him.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Thanks. And it was written or directed by Cecil B. DeMille?
It was directed by DeMille.
Okay. Now, this film was supposed to be shot in Arizona, but it ended up being one of the first big productions in L.A., in Hollywood.
That's right. It was Samuel Goldwyn, actually, who talked his brother-in-law, Jesse Lasky, who was a vaudevillian, into going into the movie business with him. And they bought a property called The Squaw Man, which had been a fairly successful Broadway play. And then they went to hire a director. They went actually looking for a successful writer named William DeMille. And they went to DeMille's mother to ask if William DeMille might work on the script. And she said, no, he's tied up, but you might be interested in my other son, Cecil, who at that point was really the family ne'er-do-well, didn't quite know what career he was going to pursue for the rest of his life. And anyway, he did become the director of that film, got on the train to film it in Flagstaff, Arizona. When he got off the train, Arizona didn't look like the West to him. It wasn't what he had imagined all this time. So he got back on the train and went to the end of the line, which happened to be Los Angeles. And he was there but a few days when he rented a barn in which to make the film, in, as he called it, in a telegram home, a place called Hollywood. And he wrote a telegram back to Goldwyn back in New York asking if he could rent a barn to make that first movie.
Well, Goldwyn was initially pretty upset at this idea, wasn't he? Because it was even farther away than he thought.
Absolutely. And you see, with Goldwyn, Goldwyn believed in absolute control. So whenever anything got out of his hands, to say nothing of out of his sight, he really started to panic.
So how did they end up moving their production to Hollywood?
Well, ultimately, there were several good reasons to move to Hollywood. And in fact, movies did make a pit stop in Fort Lee, New Jersey for a while. After New York, Fort Lee became the movie capital of the world. And then by the late teens, Hollywood began to catch on. The city of Los Angeles was building up. Of course, weather was very good out there. And the city of L.A. offered a lot of different scenery, a lot of different topography that they could play with. There, within a two-hour drive, you could have the ocean, the desert, the mountains. So it was really quite suitable for filming.
Well, how important was Goldwyn's decision to move his operation to Hollywood in the establishment of Hollywood as the capital of the film industry?
Well, I think it was rather important. It was really he who was the one who took over what later became the MGM Studios. He bought that big studio in Culver City, and when the Goldwyn Company merged into MGM, they took the studio as well. But just his presence on the scene had a great effect. You see, the studio system was building up, and if you did not belong to that studio system, you were basically a fly-by-night independent producer. Goldwyn was the first independent producer really to bring some artistic integrity to the films he made. He was not there just to make a fast buck. He was really there for the duration, and I think his presence alone had a great impact on the rest of the film community.
Well, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk more about Samuel Goldwyn and about the writing of your biography of him. A. Scott Berg is my guest. His new book is called Goldwyn, A Biography. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Scott Berg spent 10 years writing his new biography of Samuel Goldwyn. Goldwyn's son approached Berg to write the book and gave him access to his father's archives. Berg's first book was a biography of the literary editor Maxwell Perkins. Well, I was just reading in the New York Times that Samuel Goldwyn Jr., the person who approached you to write this book, is re-releasing Wuthering Heights in honor of its 50th anniversary. This was one of Samuel Goldwyn's favorite of his own productions. So let's talk about this movie a little bit. First of all, do you know more about why it's getting re-released?
Well, I think mostly because of the 50th anniversary, and it does happen to coincide with my book coming out. I think that possibly has something to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
It also occurred to Sam Goldwyn Jr. that this is one of those 50-year-old movies that still works. I mean, it's just an amazing movie, the power it has. It's really as effective today as it was in 1939, I think.
Yet Samuel Goldwyn didn't want to do the movie when the script was first offered to him.
No, it's true. In fact, almost everyone in Hollywood was reluctant to make it. It was a depressing, dark love story. It really wasn't like the Hollywood love stories that were being cranked out. And the main reason he was interested in it, besides hearing the story and getting moved by it, he certainly never read the book, he had Merle Oberon under contract, and he realized that she could be a very good Kathy. So that was primarily what prompted him to take it.
Mm-hmm. So, you say that one of the things that confused him about the movie is that there's flashbacks, and this left him baffled. I mean, how much did he meddle with the making of the movie?
Well, meddled. I would say this. Sam Goldwyn really had everything to do with every aspect of making all his movies. At the same time, I think one of his talents was he knew how to harness talent, and he always was attracted to the best talent. In this particular case, he bought the script that had been written on speculation by Ben Hecht and Charles MacArthur, you know, two of the most important playwrights in America of the day, and they really wrote a wonderful screenplay. So he began with some very good material. Then he got director William Wyler, then he began hiring the cast, but he always let each of the departments do its own work. I mean, when Wyler was actually filming, Goldwyn usually stayed off the set, but the minute the film began to come in as something other than how he envisioned it, then he would step in and start to make waves.
Merle Oberon died shortly before you were able to talk with her.
Literally days.
Yeah. Were you able to interview Laurence Olivier?
I was, actually. I didn't get much time with him, in fact. And he had written a bit about Wuthering Heights anyway, and he had, had spoken to some other interviewers, and so I was able to get that. He was one, at the time I went to interview him, he was reluctant to talk because he was writing his own book.
Is this the kind of thing you run into a lot, that actors want to save their memories for their own memoirs?
To be honest with you, he was the only one.
Uh-huh.
And then, as it turns out, when I finally read his book, he hardly mentioned Wuthering Heights at all. So I went back and fired a few important questions I had to him.
And what did he tell you?
Well, what we got into was really the trauma on that set. It was just constant bickering among everybody. There was nobody happy during the entire making of that picture. Olivier thought Merle Oberon was really just a little tramp who had gotten lucky in the movies. Merle Oberon thought Laurence Olivier was this rather pompous stage actor who was a bit hammy and kept spitting in her face every time they would do scenes close to each other. William Wyler, who was known in Hollywood for years as 40 Take Wyler, for just reason, literally used to do 40 and 50 takes at a time. So he was never content with the way it was going. The actors were being driven crazy having to do scenes over again. Merle got sick and had to be taken to the hospital, but still hadn't done the hurricane sequence the way Wyler wanted it. So Sam Goldwyn came up with the idea that they would heat the rainwater that was being sent through propellers during the hurricane scenes. And so the only way she would do her scenes was with warm water, basically. So it just went on and on like this. It was just a nightmare.
And you wouldn't know it to see the movie.
Well, that's it. You see it, and it's just this absolutely evocative, wonderful, romantic film that totally works.
Well, if making Wuthering Heights and working with William Wyler were among Samuel Goldwyn's best decisions, I think it's fair to say one of his worst decisions was to try to turn the actress Anna Sten into the new Greta Garbo.
Oh, boy. Yes, this was probably the low point of Sam Goldwyn's career. Yes, Garbo had become the greatest star in the world, needless to say, and every producer was trying to come up with his Garbo, and he discovered an actress from the Ukraine named Anna Sten and poured millions of dollars into three huge vehicles for her, Nana, and then a movie called We Live Again, and then a third movie called The Wedding Night with Gary Cooper. And once Goldwyn saw all three movies had failed at the box office and that she couldn't even bring in a crowd when Gary Cooper was in the picture, he just dropped her, never saw her again, and that was that.
What were some of his techniques for trying to transform her into a new Garbo?
Well, first of all, he tried to cultivate this air of mystery about her, and he kept her from talking to the press, and he stashed her away. Of course, he was smart enough to know that she really didn't speak English very well either, so it was just as well that she didn't talk to anybody. And then he had these films written for her. He really had vehicles made. And of course, this was the day when producers did that. They really made movies to showcase stars. This was really part of the studio system then. And Goldwyn, who wasn't part of the system, really had to scrounge. He really had to look for crumbs and try to make it into a loaf.
My guest is Scott Berg, and we're talking about his new biography of Samuel Goldwyn. Goldwyn was one of the few, perhaps the only, I don't know, mogul in Hollywood who opposed the imprisonment of the Hollywood Ten. And when he was subpoenaed by UAC, he said that the most un-American activity which I have observed in connection with the hearings is the committee itself. Was he just being different from everybody else, or did he genuinely believe did he genuinely oppose what UAC was doing?
Yes, I would say both to those.
But he was both ornery and he genuinely.
Yes, he was
it.
Both, and I'll tell you, it was interesting, and this will reveal something about my source too. When I interviewed Lillian Hellman, which I did rather extensively for
and she had
book,
written for him.
Exactly, she was his big screenwriter in the late 30s and early 40s, and indeed they did several successful pictures together, including The Little Foxes, which Goldwyn called The Three Little Foxes. But she, during the interview, said that Sam Goldwyn, the only reason he stood up against all the other producers and HUAC was because he was being different. But when I was going through the files, through the archives back in the 40s, I found telegrams from Lillian Hellman thanking Sam Goldwyn for taking such a strong stand. And the fact is, he really did lay his name and his company on the line And it was a rather bold position. And I think ultimately the reason the committee never called Goldwyn, although they did subpoena him, is I think they were so afraid that he would draw so much sympathy to his side that they didn't. And no, I think he took a very gutsy stand there, to be honest with you.
Did your opinion of movie moguls change during the course of writing this book?
Well, it did to some extent in that I realized how great these men were. I mean, they all came from such humble origins, and they really created entire empires. And just the sheer energy and aspirations alone really made me think a lot differently about them. Beyond that, though, I think it goes back to the American dream again, which certainly Samuel Goldwyn believed in. And these stories to them, they were not just out to make money. I mean, Samuel Goldwyn would have liked nothing more than to have been a very rich man. But every time he got up to bat to make a movie, to make a Wuthering Heights that nobody else wanted to make, he really was trying to leave a mark somewhere. He really was interested in the perpetuation of his name. And I think he saw he could do that through his movies somehow. And he wanted that name, Goldwyn, to stand for quality, to stand for something different. And, you know, all the other moguls were like that to an extent. They believed in those movies.
One last question about Samuel Goldwyn. His movie career starts at the very beginning of movies, in 1913.
That's right.
What about where his career ends? Now, he died in 1974.
That's right.
Does his movie career end at a pivotal point in movie history?
Well, I think it does, really, and in a way doesn't quite end in that most of Hollywood's product today is made by independent producers, men and women now, who really function as Samuel Goldwyn had all those years. There is no studio system as there was, and therefore producers are really following the example he set. The only major difference being, and this is what made Goldwyn unique, is that every time he made a movie, he had no partners, no parent company, no stockholders. Sam Goldwyn went to the bank, took out a loan, and put up something as collateral. So I think that's a good lesson for today's independent producers, too. A lesson about commitment, really.
Is your next book going to be a biography?
I think it will be. One has to approach these things very carefully, since it means you're going to seal the next decade of your life in that envelope. But I think I would like to write another biography of a 20th century American cultural figure.
Mm-hmm.
Not in the movies and probably not in literature.
Well, Scott, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your work and about Goldwyn's work. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
My guest has been A. Scott Berg, and his new biography of Samuel Goldwyn, called Goldwyn, A Biography, is published by Knopf. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. After Gidget and the Flying Nun, Sally Field had to prove she could be more than cute and spunky. She since won 2 Oscars for Places in the Heart and Norma Rae. Coming up, Sally Field confesses she used to really be Gidget. Also, critic Ken Tucker reviews the film that won the Oscar for Best Picture back in 1936, The Great Ziegfeld. It's now out on home video. And in our weekly performance spot, pianist Dave McKenna plays a medley of songs in tune with the month of April. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Michael Richards. Norwegian officials say a Soviet nuclear-powered submarine appears to have gone down about 300 miles off the coast of Norway following an underwater accident and fire. U.S. officials say that there were definitely casualties on board, but declined to estimate how many. They say the sub managed to surface for a time in the Norwegian Sea after the accident, and that at least one Soviet ship had arrived on the scene. White House News Secretary Marlon Fitzwater said the accident appears to involve a Soviet Mike submarine, one of the Russian Navy's newer attack subs. As pressure grows for the Bush administration to take over the cleanup in the aftermath of the Alaska oil spill, President Bush said today he's sending military troops to help. More from Elizabeth Arnold.
A team of military personnel is headed to Alaska to assess how the Coast Guard and Department of Defense can help in the mop-up of oil. President Bush announced today the federal government will do everything possible to return the affected area to its original state. The president says he's well aware of the size of the task.
The job of cleaning up the oil from both the sea and the affected land areas will be massive, prolonged, and frustrating.
The administration does not intend to let Exxon off the hook financially and will review oil spill contingency plans nationwide. But Valdez Mayor John Devens still isn't happy.
I'm going to continue to fuss until we get some commitment to do something about providing some form of low-interest loan to the people that need it until they can settle with Exxon.
Transportation Secretary Samuel Skinner is still negotiating with Exxon about who should pay for a short-term loan program. For National Public Radio, I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Washington.
A member of Canada's parliament says a Lebanese hijacker holding about half a dozen hostages on board a Greyhound bus is demanding the release of some prisoners jailed in Lebanon. He's also demanding the withdrawal of foreign troops from the country. The bus is now parked on the grounds of the Canadian Parliament complex in Ottawa. Sharpshooters from the Royal Canadian Mounted Police are surrounding the vehicle. It was making a trip from Montreal to New York when it was seized. A key member of Congress has called for increased U.S. aid, including military aid, for the non-communist resistance in Cambodia. Stephen Solars, the chairman of the House Subcommittee on Asian and Pacific Affairs, says that the stepped-up aid is needed to facilitate a political settlement in Cambodia and to prevent a return to power of the Khmer Rouge. Over 1 million Cambodians died under Khmer Rouge rule, NPR's Ted Clark reports.
The non-communist resistance really faces 2 adversaries in Cambodia: the Vietnamese-backed regime in Phnom Penh, and the Khmer Rouge. At a news conference today, Congressman Solars said a stronger non-communist resistance will increase pressure on the Vietnamese-backed regime to strike a deal. And he said the non-communist resistance should also be strengthened because it may be the last best hope we have against the return of the Khmer Rouge, which is also battling the Phnom Penh regime.
I think the time has come for us to now recognize that in addition to the various forms of non-lethal assistance we've been providing, there is now a need for military assistance as well.
The State Department favors increased aid, one official said today. The question of what kind of aid, military or otherwise, is currently under discussion. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
The House Ethics Committee is examining testimony that Speaker Jim Wright asked congressional aides to help set up promotional events for his book. In the weeks that followed the directive, Wright was signing books at a Capitol Hill bookstore and the National Press Club and appearing on talk shows promoting it. A former congressional aide has testified that Wright asked him to sign an affidavit swearing that the work he did on Wright's book while on the federal payroll was completely voluntary. Stock prices were higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose nearly 13 points to close the week at 2304.80. Declines led advances 8-5 on a moderate volume. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Spring, taxes are just about due, and here's something else you can add to the list of seasonal inevitabilities, hearing different versions of Take Me Out to the Ballgame on public radio. This new version has become one of our favorites. It was recorded in our studio by Boston-based pianist Dave McKenna, who joins us today in our weekly performance spot.
I got a little medley of spring songs. More specifically, these tunes have April in the title. So here's wishing you a green and pleasant spring.
In case you're wondering, that was April in Paris, Lost April, and I'll Remember April. Dave McKenna's latest recording, No More Uzo for Puzo, is on the Concord record label. This is Fresh Air. Sally Field began her acting career starring in the TV sitcoms Gidget and The Flying Nun. It took a while for her to be taken seriously as a film actress, but her work has been recognized with 2 Academy Awards for her roles as a union organizer in Norma Rae and as a widow struggling to hold her family and her farm together in Places in the Heart. Her latest film, Punchline, has just been released on video. In Punchline, Sally Field played Lila Kritzik, a suburban housewife and mother, with a new interest, stand-up comedy. To prepare for the part, Field went on stage at comedy clubs. She also wrote some of the material that she performed in the film. But Field told me that doing comedy didn't come easy to her.
It's very hard to find... Comedy is a very personal thing, and it has to come from a person's life and a person's vision of the world. And it's very hard to do that and create that for a person that you don't know. I was doing it for a person that didn't exist, Lila. Now, I use that as an excuse. Probably if I had to do it for myself, I couldn't do it, which is the truth. I mean, I realized that, and I think I knew that before, but oh well. You know, doing stand-up takes a certain gift, and you can't really learn that gift. You can try to tap into the places in yourself that you find your own humor, but that doesn't mean that your gifts will ever... be the same as, say, Robin Williams or Roseanne Barr. You just can't make it happen just by asking it to. I think that in the film, Lila pulls it off, but Sally Field will never be up there again, you know what I mean?
For the 2 roles that you got Academy Awards for, your roles in Places in the Heart and Norma Rae, you played Southern women. In this role, in Punchline, you play a New Jersey housewife who's testing out her comedy act. She's from suburban New Jersey, and your clothes are very interesting in it. The coat that you wear is this long plaid coat with a fake fur, I'm not sure which, trimmed collar, and you have these big tortoiseshell square-shaped glasses, and I was wondering who chose the clothes and the glasses. Was it you, or did you have costume designer for that?
No, actually, I just felt that Lila was not, you know, a real trendsetter here, and I didn't think she was a woman that was able to go buy a new coat every year at Bloomingdale's. I don't think every woman is, or even was the kind of woman that looked through the various magazines that tell us what we should look like every year. I think she's a person that got a comfortable coat 10 years ago. It looked good to her. It had a nice little fur collar, and she said, "Hey, I like my coat." And then I think that when she got to the club and wanted to be funny, I think she thought clothes would help. And she never really was with it enough to know that wasn't it, that her clothes did not look like the rest of the gang. And felt it was sort of the character in this kind of feeble attempt constantly at being somebody else until the end when she just wears a nice simple black dress and just as herself. She's constantly trying to be somebody else, and as you know, you can't make it when you're trying to be somebody else.
TV audiences were first introduced to you in the role of Gidget. And I was wondering, you know, her personality is as this pert, lovable teenager. Were you a teenager at all in that mode?
Oh, yeah. I got Gidget because I was Gidget on one level. I mean, there was another dark level to me that stayed hidden that came out in later work. But the level of me that was the easiest to present to people was the Gidget side of myself. You know, the all-American, giggling little thing, little American girl. And I always was that. I fit into that mold so easily as a young woman growing up in 1964 and the late 1950s. It was someplace for me to feel that I was fine. You know, I fit. It was when Sandra Dee was the number one box office female star, and I seemed to be a place for me to live, as far as I knew.
Then from Gidget, you played the Flying Nun, which I understand that you first turned down and then accepted.
Who wouldn't? I turned it down. I know that there are people in this country who like it. I don't mean to say that there's anything wrong with them, but I didn't like it. And I did it primarily because I was frightened.
That you'd sink without a trace?
Yeah, that I would. I had several people around me at the time who said, do it, do it. This is all you've got. And I think I was too frightened at the time to reach out for my dreams. When I was 19 years old and I had done my first television series, I didn't have the guts. I thought I had the talent, and I certainly had the desire to act, but I didn't have the guts to walk away from television and say, go to New York and study and live in a small apartment and do off Broadway, which I think somewhere was my dream, but I was frightened. I was frightened to leave. I'd never been out of California. I'd never been on an airplane, and I was really unsophisticated.
Well, you did something pretty gutsy shortly after The Flying Nun. If I understand this correctly, you fired your agent and your business manager after The Flying Nun, and I was wondering what the last straw was that made you dump them and find other people.
I think it was this the third television series I did called A Girl With Something Extra, which, you see, you don't even know about. So.
That's right.
It had nothing extra whatsoever, except it was, I think, the last straw. It was the final kicker where I said, you know what, I've got nowhere to go except down. So why not just go for the things you want to be? What are you waiting for?
What was your strategy for doing that?
I don't think I had any strategy at all. I think I was simply going on just sheer instinct. I don't think I had it worked out. I don't think I was really sure as to what feelings were going on inside of me. I was angry at myself and all sorts of things. I had two children. I was supporting the children. I was scared. You know, these things, and having children, you know, as people know, it changes your life. And I had two little children, and I think I just felt if I was capable of taking care of them, then I was capable of taking care of myself. And I think I felt I had to get out and fight for them. And I think that probably propelled me forward.
I think of it as being Sybil. I think of Sybil as being the role that really turned your career around. You got to play a multiple personality.
Mm-hmm.
And that was plenty of opportunities for great acting and something like that.
Yeah. Well, that was certainly my opportunity to really do what I had trained and worked mm-hmm. and so hard to do. I got a break before that, which really got me in to read for Sybil, which was in this little Bob Rafelson film called Stay Hungry with Jeff Bridges and Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Right.
That, I think that was my industry kind of break, even though the public didn't see it. And then I got to do Sybil, and I think things started to turn, but it's all very gradual. I don't, you know, still it was a, you know, it was a long time before Norma came along, and it's a long time of just, you know, having to be very certain that you're going to make it, that you've got it.
Can I ask a perhaps stupid question? You were in your early 40s, I think, when you had your baby, your mm-hmm. your third child.
Yes,
and
I still am in my early 40s.
Right, yes. I was wondering if you were concerned at all during your pregnancy or shortly afterwards about what effects the pregnancy would have on your body, because I know how conscious you have to be of your body and yeah. of how you look when you're an actress.
Well, actually, I didn't think of that a whole lot. I mean, there's a side of me that said, what are you doing? You worked so long on those abs, honey. Don't let them, like, fall apart like this. And then the other side of me said, who cares? You know, who cares about those things? Because, you know, a child is so much more important than you know, your stomach muscles. And also, you underestimate what a miracle the human body is. Because my body is coming back together. I've hardly even worked out. I think it all has to do with where women are now. You know, we are much healthier than our mothers were at this age. And goodness knows we have worked out much more than they probably ever did in their lives as a general rule. You know, there's some women, I'm sure, who worked out a lot. And I think that our bodies, even at 41, are able to just sort of bounce right back if you pay attention to them.
Well, Sally Field, I thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Actress Sally Field, her most recent film, Punchline, has just been released on home video. Here's some of her stand-up act from the film.
This gentleman right here, sir, what's your name?
Murray.
Murray, trust me on this one. Your life is funny, Murray. What do you do for a living?
I'm an insurance salesman.
You're an insurance salesman? Did you ever want to be anything else? Come on, think back with me. You're 4, you're 3, you're 2, you're a small child, you're dressing up, it's Halloween. You know, all the other boys, they're firemen, they're policemen, they're Zorro, they're Batman, and cute little Murray, whose mother adores him, is a...
an insurance salesman.
An insurance salesman. Murray, this can't be true. What, you dressed up in a polyester suit and you handed out cards with your name on it?
This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams has the answer to the question, what's coming up on All Things Considered? Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev in London has said he would stop the production of weapons-grade nuclear material for nuclear devices there. He said that today. Also, President Bush in Washington is promising additional federal resources to help in the cleanup of the oil spill in Prince William Sound in Alaska. The Coast Guard will be given more authority. The president said his ultimate goal was complete restoration of the ecology and the economy of Prince William Sound. Also, we'll talk with Bonnie Raitt about her new album entitled Nick of Time and about traveling on the road for 2 decades playing slide guitar and the blues.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The impresario Flo Ziegfeld was known for his extravagant stage shows replete with bevies of singing and dancing girls. The Great Ziegfeld was a 1936 biopic in the spirit of the lavish Ziegfeld Follies. The cast included William Powell, Myrna Loy, Louise Rayner, and Frank Morgan. The Great Ziegfeld is now out on home video. Critic Ken Tucker has this review.
There's no way you could really call The Great Ziegfeld a good movie. It's much too uneven and disjointed and occasionally boring for that. But it's certainly an awful lot of fun, and now that its generous 3-hour length is available on video cassette, you can always fast forward through the slow parts. This 1936 film was ostensibly the screen biography of the master showman producer Flo Ziegfeld, but director Robert Z. Leonard used this movie to film an all-star variety show as well. William Powell plays Ziegfeld with a lot of snappy charm. If anything, he's even sharper here than he was in the Thin Man movies. The way Powell plays him, Ziegfeld was always on the lookout for new acts to book into his elaborate stage shows, and the talent was always seeking him out as well. In this typically fast-paced scene, Ziegfeld is being pitched by a pair of hack songwriters, one of whom is William Demarest, later to appear in Preston Sturges' movies, and as Uncle Charlie on TV's My Three Sons. While he's hearing them out, Ziegfeld is also being hyped on a new singer, who turns out to be none other than the now legendary Fanny Brice.
You say, Flo.
I know. You got a new song.
I'll say we have. Play him the melody, Danny. Oh, you'll go crazy over this, Flo. Mr. Ziegfeld. I must interrupt you. This is important. I've got an idea.
How much will it save?
This has nothing to do with money.
You feeling all right, Sam?
Well, I have my usual headache, but this is about talent.
Something good and cheap, no doubt.
Exactly. It's a young lady of the name of Brice. Fanny Brice. She's working in burlesque.
Say, I've seen that gal, Flo.
Pretty?
Well, yes and no. Shut your eyes and listen? Yes. Open them and look? No. What a great performer.
We should see her at once, tonight.
Everyone was singing, dancing, springing at the wedding yesterday.
There are lots of corny jokes in The Great Ziegfeld, and the plot regularly veers into soap opera. There are long, interminable stage show sequences that are little more than fashion shows. Dancers strut across the stage in elaborate costumes, and periodically the camera cuts to Ziegfeld in the audience, smiling grimly. But then, after just such a tedious sequence, something absolutely wonderful pops up, like a young and eager Ray Bolger, singing and dancing to She's Not My Girl.
if she's riding in a limousine with some millionaire or a college dean. If she's the grandest thing you've ever seen, then she's not my girl. If her smile is like the southern skies, with California sunshine in her eyes, if she's the type that you could idolize, then she's not the girl for me.
The great Ziegfeld won the Oscar for Best Picture. It didn't deserve that kind of reward, but these days, if you want to catch up on a whole era of show business that's gone forever, The Great Ziegfeld is a wonderful time capsule.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, a look at jazz from its early days to the present. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album by 81-year-old bandleader and saxophonist Benny Carter. Carter has been active since the early 20s and was a major influence in the evolution of the jazz saxophone. Then I talk with jazz trombonist Ray Anderson, who critic Gary Giddens called one of the most compellingly original trombonists of the past decade. And TV critic David Bianculli discusses three new shows debuting on NBC. David has previews and predictions on their prospects for an extended life. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet. Production assistance from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Research assistance from Christopher Cook. Our engineer is Thad Kirk. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.